We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Bill Hammack, and this is Focus 580. Good morning. Today, we look at Shakespeare, but in a way never before attempted. We view him through the lens of his rival theater company, which featured the plays of Christopher Marlowe and Ben Jonson. My guest today has for nearly 40 years elucidated Elizabethan stage conditions. Poring over archival material and anecdotal scraps, he's become one of the most distinguished authority on Shakespeare's staging. And he's written a book, Shakespeare's Opposites, The Admiral's Company, 1594 to 1625. So I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area, or if you're anywhere else, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. And if you like, you can instant message questions to me on any IM system using Bill Engineer Guy, all one word. So let's welcome to Focus 580, Andrew Gurr. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, I'm here.
Yes. So in the period covered by your book, which is the early 17th century, London has two and only two acting companies. And I want to know, who were they, and why did this come about that there were only two?
That was an attempt by the government to answer the objections of the Lord Mayor of London. The Lord Mayor of London at this time was elected by the major citizens, who were all major employers. And the employers found the idea of their employees taking time off from work to go to plays a very bad idea, because the plays are always staged in daylight in the afternoons. So in 1594, there was a compromise set up between the Privy Council, which really was the government at the time, and the Lord Mayor, in which all playing inside the city, in the inns in the city, was totally banned, and only two playhouses were licensed for use, one in the northern suburbs and one in the southern suburbs. This actually had an advantage for the Privy Council, because the Lord Mayor had no control over the suburbs, so they were able to set them up. One of the men who set it up was Henry Carey, who was the Lord Chamberlain and therefore responsible for plays, and actually had the duty of presenting the best plays to entertain the Queen at court every Christmas. Mm-hmm. And the other was his son-in-law, the Lord Admiral Charles Howard, who was actually, I think, the real genius behind the deal. And he was the one who narrowed the whole business of playing. There were companies of players always trying to flood into London, and he restricted them to two, one under the patronage of the Lord Chamberlain, Henry Carey, and one under his own patronage, the Lord Admiral. And they were the only ones that were officially allowed to perform for the next few years. And in fact, the only companies that performed at court were these two, the Lord Chamberlain's men and the Lord Admiral's men.
So let's sort this out a little bit. The Lord Chamberlain's men, whose patron was Henry Carey, yeah, was Shakespeare's company at the Globe. Is that right?
Shakespeare was employed, I think, as a playwright rather than as an actor. He never got a very high reputation as an actor. Mm-hmm. But he had something like 10 plays, which had been very successful by then. So he and they went into the Lord Chamberlain's company. Mm-hmm. And Christopher Marlowe had been murdered a year before these new companies were set up. So, and all of his plays belonged to Edward Allen, who was the most famous actor of the time.
So this,
he was made leader of the other company, the Lord Admiral's men, which my book is about.
Right. So the Admiral's men, and their patron was Charles Howard, later Prince Henry, right?
That's right, yeah.
They had Marlowe's plays, and their star again was Edward Allen, right?
Edward Allen, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
he became very rich and very famous as through his acting as time went on. He was the most richest actor of the lot, and he founded Dulwich College, which is still in existence, and which inherited all of his papers, which means that all of the early resources of the company in its first years were lodged in Dulwich College and have therefore come down to today. None of the papers of the Shakespeare Company have survived.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's compare the two companies and start out with a little bit of what do we know about each? I mean, number of plays that survived. Can you compare those two companies?
In a rough sort of way, yes. We know that all of the Shakespeare plays written from written both before 1594 and then from the establishment of the company onwards, they were all that we know about. Romeo and Juliet, Richard II, right up to Hamlet. All of those plays were written for the Chamberlain's company at the two playhouses they used through that period.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all we know. That's the sad thing about it. We know of four other plays that the Chamberlain's men performed during those years when they were doing all the Shakespeare plays.
So only 19 or 20 plays or so. Is my math correct?
Yeah,
there?
something like 22 plays,
mm-hmm.
And a similar number of plays are known we know of for the Admiral's men, but also we have the records from Dulwich College, which give us an indication of the incredibly large number of plays which have not survived that they played. We know of 160-odd plays that the Admiral's men performed up to about 1600. We only know of 20 that Shakespeare's company played.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a huge difference between the two.
And you argue in this book that this, I think you call it a duopoly, if I remember the word.
That it was a shared monopoly.
A shared monopoly, only two licensed theater companies. And you argue it was actually, if I read the book correctly, good for the public and good for theater. How so?
Well, it posed major problems for the companies because being only the two of them, they were the only two allowed to perform. That meant that Londoners had to go to one or the other. And if you got folk who were idle layabouts around town, of whom there were a great many, as there always are, who wanted to go to the theatre every day, they always wanted a new play.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a unique opportunity in one sense for these two companies in that they had exclusive right to perform in London. But at the same time, they had this massive appetite for new plays because they had to perform a new play every single day. We assumed that this was just a matter of doing as modern repertory companies do a play for a few weeks and then
mm-hmm.
put on a new play. That wasn't feasible then. And the Henslow records, the records that come from Dulwich College, are unique in giving us a record that the Admiral's men, and presumably also the Shakespeare Company, because they were doing exactly the same thing for the same reasons, that the Admiral's men performed a different play every day of the week, 6 days a week.
And but they did a different play every day of the week, but you said it wasn't feasible just to do a play for a few weeks and then another play. Is that because that was the only entertainment option available? Or?
Yeah, it was the only entertainment option, and people did not want to see the same play mm-hmm. day after day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with only two plays in town and something like 200,000 people in London, of whom at least 10% were regular playgoers.
So
that meant something like 20,000 people had to be satisfied every week.
So let's look at how they did it. I mean, one of the points in your book is that both companies were faced with a problem of having only a limited set of actors and that people would tire of familiar faces. So how did the Admiral's Club deal with this?
This is one of the things that, again, you don't get in from the Shakespeare repertory. The Admiral's men invented the idea of playing games with disguises. I mean, it was quite standard in some of the big plays where they did massive history plays with masses of characters that a lot of the actors would double the parts that they played. That meant they would simply put on a different costume and claim to be a different person in the same play. Doubling is something that small acting groups still do, and
mm-hmm.
it's a standard practice. But in those days, everybody would recognize the actors, you know, because they went regularly to the playhouses. They'd see the same actors playing a different part every day. And therefore, what the Admiral's men invented was the idea of plays of disguise, so that an actor would disguise himself as somebody else and would be recognizably still the same actor by his face, because the audience would know his face, but would be claiming to be somebody different. And, I mean, there are some wonderful games played in the early plays of the Admiral's Men, like, for instance, John O'Kent and John O'Cumber, in which who are the names of two rival magicians. And in one at one point, John O'Kent enters disguised as John O'Cumber, and meets Jonicumba, disguised as Jonah Kent.
Hmm.
Now, if you were a stranger to the theatre, you'd be absolutely confused by that. But what that meant essentially for everybody who knew the actors taking these parts was that they would immediately recognize the joke.
So this was a little bit of a game, kind of like an Easter egg, as we call them in the internet world, a hidden thing that you see a performer in their disguise, you penetrate the disguise, and there's that moment of recognition.
Absolutely that, yes, yes. And this was a game they invented for themselves within the first few months of doing this day by day, different play every day.
And this is almost a meta level of theater. Is that a term that you use at all?
Yes, it is meta theater. It was quite brilliant meta theater. Mm-hmm. They even sent up their own plays because there is one wonderful, the first comedy that George Chapman wrote for them called The Blind Beggar of Alexandria has nearly a third of all the lines are spoken by one actor, Edward Allen, the great man who founded Dulwich College.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, he did a mockery of his famous Marlowe parts. He was a player of Marlowe's Tamburlaine. He was a player of Barabbas in The Jew of Malta, the famous Jew of Malta, and other parts. And in the Blind Beggar of Alexandria, they set him up as the central character, the blind beggar character, actually a hero in disguise, who then poses as two other figures in disguise, one parodying Tamburlaine, the other parodying Barabbas, the Jew of Malta, his other famous roles. So it was totally theatre for audiences who were absolutely in the know about the rest of the repertory by the company.
Which would certainly be their regular patrons who would go, I don't know, once a week, every other day, something like this, with great frequency, right?
Absolutely that.
You mentioned the play Look About You, which had no less than 16 inventive disguises, and that seemed to me yes. to be really the pinnacle of this. Is that the same performer disguised 16 times or different
parts? No. It had 8 different characters, all of whom played games with disguises. It was, I think, the ultimate play of disguises. In fact, the records that we have talk about a play called Disguises, which I think is Look About You, because it's the only play to which that name would fit absolutely perfectly.
Well, yes,
and the whole thing is based on characters switching roles at high speed, and usually telling the audience, just in case they didn't realize what was going on, now I've got his costume, I will put it on and pretend to be him, etc. And it has the same trick as with Jonah Kent and Jonicumba, the two magicians play, in which the two leading characters, the two leading disguises, discover one another, both dressed as the same person.
Mm-hmm. And so is Look About You much of a play, or is it really all meta-play?
It's all meta-play, it is. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's not a serious play. It actually uses some fairly serious incidents from English history, but then history plays were very popular at the time. What it does is make a joke of it. It's actually a brilliant farce.
Hmm.
We tend to find farce a bit difficult to cope with these days. You know, we assume that plays have to be serious to be any good.
Mm-hmm.
But they are absolutely, it is an absolutely superb farce.
Is Look About You ever performed today?
I've been to a reading of it, which actually caused a lot of difficulty. We got the readers of each part to wear a hat, a different hat according to which part they were pretending to play. And once you recognize the reader as the particular character who was then disguising himself right, left, and center, it became quite recognizable. But I mean, the real trouble with the reason why so few of these plays are probably performed now is because we don't have audiences with the same kind of intimacy, the same kind of intimate mm-hmm. relationship to the actors,
mm-hmm.
not in the big cities anyway. You might find them in small communities, where the community know the actors who are doing the various parts, and you could then have the same sort of game.
So it's using
the actors' familiarity with the audience's familiarity with the actors.
Right. So it's a little bit like if you watch a sitcom that's very old that you haven't seen before, and you watch one of them, you don't get the in jokes. You don't understand what is going on.
Exactly. That's the problem. The plays of this kind are absolutely crammed with in jokes. and we miss most of them. In fact, it's really a matter for study for Shakespeare, because we don't know what the in-jokes, we don't know many of the in-jokes that there were in the Shakespeare companies, but if they're anything like the Admiral's Men's plays, Shakespeare's plays must have been crammed with in-jokes as well.
Well, I want to follow up on that, but first of all, this is Focus 580. I'm Bill Hammack. I'm talking with Andrew Gurr, author of Shakespeare's Opposites, The Admiral's Company, 1594 to 1625. For nearly 40 years, he has elucidated Elizabethan stage conditions, becoming one of the most distinguished authorities on Shakespeare's staging. Today, we're discussing that main rival to Shakespeare's Chamberlain players, The Admiral's Company, and I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Or you can send a question via instant message to Bill Engineer Guy, all one word on nearly any instant message system. So we've been discussing disguise plays, and you have apparently a lot of textual evidence that's what the Chamberlain's Company did. Now, in the penumbra of your book is always, what does this tell us about Shakespeare? And the Admiral's Company, of course, is itself interesting, but this is a reflection on the Elizabethan theater. So is there a sense that perhaps Shakespeare's plays involve many more disguises than we knew about, and that we're not reading them in the correct way?
I think it's very likely that there were a lot of in-jokes, meta-jokes, in the Shakespeare plays, which we haven't picked up. There's one I can quote to you, for instance, which is, to me, wonderfully suggestive if the person actually speaking it was the actor Shakespeare. It comes from Henry IV, Part 1, the first of the Falstaff plays, in which, and it's a fairly unimportant scene, in which the Earl of Worcester is trying to tell young Hotspur, Harry Hotspur, about a dark and secret plot, the plot against King Henry, which is much of the basis of that play. And he says, I'm going to unveil you a secret which is as dark and dangerous as to walk o'er a torrent roaring loud on the unsteadfast footing of a spear. Now, that's a weird sort of metaphor to offer, simile actually, to offer to anybody. But of course, if he was talking about the unsteadfast footing of a spear, and was himself somebody known as Shakespeare, the audience would have immediately got the joke. Nobody nowadays knows that. It's not even recorded in any of the editions of the play. But that seems to me a perfect justification for one of those in jokes that we might find in Shakespeare if we knew a lot more about the company and the actors playing the parts and everything else, as we do about the Admiral's Men.
Well, that's one of the most stimulating things about your book is to come back and look at the plays that are very familiar to us in a different way. Now, both of these Elizabethan companies, the Chamberlains and Admirals, toured. Could you describe what a tour was like at the time, and, you know, did the players like them, or was this a huge burden to them?
Well, it was really a matter of money, because there were times when the theatres were closed, often for plague. In fact, one of the main reasons why the two companies were set up was because so many companies had been suffering from closure of all the theatres because of the plague, and so they had to go on tour. Touring was a kind of holiday in a way, because the demands of playing in London were absolutely intense. I mean, to play six different plays a week, the lead actors would have to learn something between 600 and 800 lines of verse for each play, and a different 600 to 800 lines every day of the week was a heavy job. But when they went on tour, of course, because they would play in a whole series of different towns and only play maybe twice or three times in each town, they only had to know three plays, and they would take the same plays to each different town. So, in a sense, going on tour was a great holiday. The main times they went on tour were usually in the summer, which is obviously usually, even in England, it doesn't rain as much in summer as it does in winter. So it's a better season for traveling. But they also, and this is something that hasn't been noticed by anybody else, but it seems evident to the Admiral's Men, that they went on tour during Lent, you know, the 40 days up to Easter, which was a religious holiday, you know, when you didn't eat meat and all those things were required. It also meant that the plays were banned because it was the period of religious contemplation up to Easter. Plays were thought to be a frivolous distraction. Therefore, they were not allowed to play during Lent. So for that 40 days, they went on tour because the towns around the country were much less rigorous, evidently, over performing at Easter. They used to go mainly down to Kent and Sussex and around the southeastern coast, near Dover and around there. And they would play two or three times in each of the small coastal towns and Maidstone and Canterbury and places like that throughout the Lent period in the depths of winter.
Now, the evidence is sketchy, but can you interpret for us a little bit whether the two companies were friendly rivals or unfriendly competitors? Did you get any sense of that?
It's much debated. I think they were. They saw themselves as a team, as two teams, as it were. And their plays, they were obviously very conscious of what the other company was performing because they frequently set up rival performances. They in fact, commissioned, the Admiral's men regularly commissioned plays that they knew the Shakespeare Company was doing. And they did their own version of the same, usually a history story. Mm-hmm. Like the story of Richard III or the story of Henry VI or King John, all of those plays, and Henry V as well, all of those subjects were taken for dramas to be performed by both companies, presumably as competing with one another. That was one feature. They also borrowed all sorts of jokes. I mean, I long ago expressed the idea that the Merry Wives of Windsor was Shakespeare's takeoff of the Admiral's Men's Angry Women of Abingdon. things are different now, but in those days, yeah. Abingdon and Windsor were both towns on the River Thames in the county of Berkshire, which is where I live, as it happens. And I thought that, you know, it's just the names of the two plays are just too similar. Both are comedies. One is about the angry women who take against one another and fight one another, and of course Shakespeare's version is about two merry women who ally themselves with one another and make fools of Falstaff. So that they're both different plays, but they're, as it were, parallel stories, each reflecting what the other one was doing.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Focus 580. Today's subject is Elizabethan theater, particularly the company that rivaled Shakespeare's in popularity, and I'm talking to Andrew Gurr. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Or you can send an instant message to Bill Engineer Guy, all one word, on nearly any instant message system. Well, you just, you know, talked a little bit about their rivalry and how it their plays influenced each other a bit. Can we sort out a little bit the influence or relationship between Marlowe and Shakespeare? Marlowe, of course, was one of the main playwrights for some of the more popular plays of the Admiral's Club. the Admiral's Company. Yeah. And some feel Marlowe is simply an evolution on the way to the Bard, but your book on the two companies suggests a much more nuanced relationship.
Yeah. I think Shakespeare admired Marlowe absolutely greatly. And indeed, I mean, he's the only poet to whom we know for certain Shakespeare made reference in his plays. As You Like It has that, you know, dead poet now, I find I saw of might, whoever loved that loved not at first sight, which is a quote from one of Marlowe's poems. And also that other very complex statement about something striking somebody more dead than a great reckoning in a little room, which is a conflation of a line in Marlowe's Jew of Malta about infinite riches in a little room, and the fact that Marlowe was supposed to be murdered in a fight over the reckoning or the bill for the entertainment that they were then taking on. So A Great Reckoning in a Little Room is an absolutely explicit allusion to Marlowe and to Marlowe's death. And that, I think, is unique in Shakespeare. There's nobody else who was clearly a contemporary poet who was as admired as Shakespeare was. And Shakespeare very deliberately imitated the great Marlowian line, the mighty line, as Ben Jonson called it, that Marlowe's plays are characterized by. I mean, Tamburlaine has echoes in Henry V, for instance, quite clearly. And that's some years after Marlowe was dead.
So is it pretty clear that Shakespeare, the relationship at the most elemental level was there were rival playwrights would see each other's plays and draw from that. So is there evidence that Shakespeare went and saw Marlowe's plays being performed?
I think he must have done. In fact, it's quite possible that he may have performed in some of them. We don't know enough about his life before he joined the Chamberlain's Company in 1594. We know he was an actor. We know he was a playwright. We know he collaborated with various other playwrights in those early years. But he does actually seem to have worked with Edward Allen for some years, particularly when he was writing Henry VI, Parts 2 and 3, and Richard III. They seem to be... There are references in those three plays which actually suggest that the Earls of Derby were particularly distinguished possible patrons of Shakespeare at the time. And that's interesting because Edward Allen's main company before he founded the Admiral's Men was a company called Lord Strange's Men, Lord Strange being brother to the Earl of Derby, one of the Stanleys from Lancashire. And there are references to the Stanley family. For instance, at the end of Richard III, when Richmond is crowned King Henry VII, he is actually crowned by the Earl of Derby. And he does so because the Earl of Derby, whose eldest son was being held hostage by Richard, decided that despite the risk to his son, he was going to fight for Richmond rather than for Richard, and therefore was in effect the guarantee that Henry VII got the crown from Richard. So it was in that sense clearly all of the early Shakespeare history plays were being written for a company that was very likely the one patronized either by the brother of the Earl of Derby, Lord Strange's Men, or by the Earl of Derby's own men.
Andrew, we have a caller. So we have a caller on line one from Morris. So caller from Morris, please go ahead.
Hi, interesting program. Thank you. I just have two quick general questions, and then I'll hang up and listen. First of all, listening to how intense their work schedules were and compared to today's actors, I'm wondering about their salaries. And I'm also wondering, as in terms of disguises, did men disguise themselves for the women's role and vice versa, or did women play women? Thank you, and I'll take my answer on the air.
Sure. So we'll start with that. What were they paid? What do you know about their finances?
We think they made something like £60 a year if they were a sharer in the company. The companies were made up, actually, it was a very democratic organization. All of the actors each bought a share in the company, which was probably cost them about £50 or £60. And they could expect, if the company did well, to make about that money in a year. Now, that's not a lot of money by modern standards, but the average working wage of an artisan was maybe 2 shillings a week, which was 1/20th of a pound, 1/10th of a pound. So they had a good life if they could do it. A quite reasonable life if they could do it.
And our caller's Our caller's second question, though, was kind of twofold. First of all, was it men and women on the stage or only men?
No, the whole business about acting was frowned on very severely, mostly by the church, but also by the Lord Mayor of London. And women on stage was regarded as not just immodest, but as it were, sexually dangerous. So the women's parts were all played by boys. presumably boys with unbroken voices, because the register middle C is the basic register both for woman's voice and for the unbroken voice of the boys. And boys played all the great women's roles.
So your book does a really wonderful job of placing us in Elizabethan times, to really sit at the Globe or the Rose or the Fortune Theaters. But I want to set the scene just a little bit. What would have been the main two public entertainment styles for a Londoner in the late 16th century? We know one of them is plays. What's the other one?
Baiting bears and balls. In fact, the suburban location for the playhouses was also where the bull baiting and the bear baiting went on. Animal baiting was terribly popular, even with royalty.
Can you describe what is bear baiting and bull baiting? What would happen?
What would happen would be that they would release a bull or a bear. The bear would often be blinded because it meant that its enemies had a better chance of surviving the experience. And they were baited by dogs. Both bulls and bears were baited by dogs. And, of course, the dogs died very frequently if the bull's horns got it or the bear's claws got it.
Mm-hmm.
There were pretty ferocious encounters. They talk about baiting. I talk about blood.
Mm-hmm.
It was all about showing blood, not human blood, but animal blood.
Hmm.
And there was something like, near the main baiting house, which was very close to the Rose, where the Admiral's men had their theatre, there were 200 dogs kenneled there, and anything up to 8 or 10 bears.
Hmm.
And you know, it was just you know, animals were seen as a form of entertainment. When Edward Allen finally became master of the bears as well as master of the bulls, which got him a lot of his money. He became very rich through bears, even more than from playing. One of his first jobs was to take two lions from the Tower of London. There was a menagerie of wild animals in the Tower of London, including two lions. And he got the lions brought to the bear baiting house. And in fact, it was a royal baiting, so that was at the Tower of London itself. And he set dogs on them. And the lions very sensibly ran away, so it was a very disappointing event, that. I thought that was very good sense of the on the lion's part.
We have another caller. There's a caller on line one from Champaign County. So, caller, line one, please go ahead.
Hi. I was struck. I know very little of any of this and haven't read a sonnet in a long time. So, but I was struck by the fact that you said that the tour of the countryside or the lesser towns was done during Lent. I'm just curious if it was not a good idea to do that in London. Why was it, or was it as simple as they would get out of town quick enough that they wouldn't disturb the city fathers or something? But then that, so, if I might ask something else and then just hang up.
Go ahead.
There was a documentaryist, I guess it was a BBC production, that made a lot of the secret Catholicism of Shakespeare. And I'm just wondering if you might say about that. Well, that seems to be even a contemporary item where Tony Blair converted right after he stepped down or something. But I'm wondering whether, that could be used to track, I guess a devout Catholic wouldn't perform during Lent. So it might have been allowed you to sort out. Then I guess it wouldn't be a secret anymore.
Well, that's an interesting way to bring those two together. So I think the callers ask a really interesting question. Is there, the question about Lent? I believe you answered, earlier. They were simply less strict out in the small towns. But is there a kind of a covert religious belief, a Catholicism behind Shakespeare that you see that you've been studying when you read the plays?
The touring in Lent was something that I think they absolutely had to do. They had to, if they didn't act, they didn't get any money, and they wanted to go on making money, so mm-hmm. they just went to places where performing during Lent wasn't a problem. The religious question is very intriguing, because a number of the celebrated actors, including the richest of all the impresarios during this period, were both Catholic. Richard Gunnell and Christopher Beeston were known to be recusants or Catholics. So there was that. Shakespeare's Catholicism, I think, is a bit of a, I wouldn't call it a red herring, but a bit of mystique. There is thought to be a document which was said to have been found in Shakespeare's house, locked away in the roof of the house in the 18th century, that was thought to be a Catholic document by John Shakespeare, Shakespeare's father, which meant that he was a Catholic. But that's been discredited completely. And the argument about Shakespeare being a secret Catholic up in Lancashire, which is another version of the idea of Shakespeare as a secret Catholic, is also has also been, I think, largely discredited. But whether Shakespeare had Catholic sympathies is a quite different question. I mean, there's an awful lot of evidence that's been recently turned up, particularly in relation to people like Edmund Campion, the Jesuit who was executed under Elizabeth, and Sir John Harrington, the Queen's own cousin, to suggest that they had very strong Catholic sympathies. But, of course, they had to keep them secret because it was, you know, it was like being communist in the States a few years ago. Mm-hmm. It was dangerous to be given that label, and you could get into real trouble. I mean, John Donne converted himself over a long and agonizing period into an anti-Catholic polemicist. Mm-hmm. He wrote some very anti-Catholic pieces as part of his proving his credentials as a good Church of England man. Shakespeare certainly, if he did have any Catholic sympathies, kept them extremely quiet, and there is no tangible evidence that he ever was a Catholic as a result.
And would he have needed to keep them extremely quiet?
Well, if you think of what happened after the gunpowder plot in 1605, I would say yes.
Sure. So
Ben Jonson, who was a far more truculent man than Shakespeare, he didn't keep quiet about anything. He actually deliberately turned Catholic at one point in order, I think, to show how as it were, anti-conformist he was. Mm-hmm. You know, some people do that, but not Shakespeare.
Now, maybe if a caller or a listener would like to probe the background of the plays a little deeper, I remember years ago, I had to read the Elizabethan World Picture by Tilliard. Is there an updated book like that that lays out kind of the background and the theology? Is there a newer book?
Yes, there's a number of books that talk about it. I mean, Tilliard himself has been fairly discredited in a way. He was a strongly royalist, monarchist guy. And, of course, Shakespeare's plays are mostly, obviously, monarchist. There is an interesting book called Shakespeare's Monarchic Principles, which I rather like, by Constance Jordan. Mm-hmm. And one or two books of that kind have come out. But an awful lot of them are take a wide range of view, just because Shakespeare was so, as it were, tight-lipped about his own beliefs. There's a book come out a couple of years ago called Shakespeare's Republicanism, which is argues the case as strongly as he can, but doesn't end up with anything absolutely convincing.
So far, we've talked about the interaction of Shakespeare and Marlowe, the content of the plays, and the composition of the companies. But your real expertise is also in the theaters, in the details of it, and that has a lot to do with the plays and how they were performed and how we interpret them. So let's focus now on the theaters themselves. What theater did the Admiral's Company act in, and how was it different from Shakespeare's Globe Theater?
We know a lot. The Admiral's Company acted in two theatres, both of which we know a great deal about. One was the Rose, of which 60% of the foundations were dug up by the archaeologists just on 20 years ago now. Mm-hmm. In fact, I was at a meeting earlier today about the Rose and the preservation of its remains. So we've got very tangible evidence about the Rose, and indeed about the audiences and the debris that the audience left behind after performances at the Rose. And after that theatre got worn out, around about 1600 or so, Edward Allen built a new theatre called The Fortune, which hasn't survived as The Rose has survived, but which the contract to the builder survives. And the contract, of course, gives you a lot of dimensions and a lot of very tangible evidence about it that we have no other playhouse. The only misfortune about that is that they commissioned to build The Fortune the man who just finished building The Globe, and it keeps saying, build it as you built The Globe, which is no help if you don't know exactly what The Globe was like.
Sure. Now, the Globe, I believe, was an outdoor, partly outdoor theater, right? Was it true of The Fortune also?
That's true of The Rose and The Fortune. They were all outdoor theaters.
Yeah.
They performed in the afternoons, between about 2 and 5 o'clock in the afternoon, because they had daylight in which to perform.
Mm-hmm. And so let's look at either The Rose or The Fortune. Were these built specifically for plays, or were they also designed with other activities in mind?
There was a theory a while ago that The Rose possibly wasn't originally intended to be a theater, because it was built very close to the Bear Garden, the amphitheater where they baited bears and bulls. But indeed, the stage was actually the last thing to be built. Inside the polygon, the circle of galleries, but it was essentially a very simple concept. What the actors before they built their theatres used to do was to perform in marketplaces. You know, on market day, mm-hmm. they would set up a booth and a stage, a platform in front of it, and perform. There are several Dutch illustrations of kermesses and paintings from this period of people acting on stages like that. And basically, the idea of building a commercial theater was simply to enclose the entire stage and the booth inside a circuit of galleries, three levels of galleries, so that people could sit, as it were, vertically above one another and look in and down on the stage. And, of course, people would stand around the stage as well, as they did in the marketplaces, because there were no seating inside what was called the yard, the interior bit, and the daylight would come in. And the value of having the galleries built in a circle around the stage was simply that they could charge for admission. Mm-hmm. In the marketplaces, where they first started playing, all they could do was take a hat around and ask for people to be generous. Mm-hmm. When they stage their play, you know, if you like the play, then give us some money. Mm-hmm. But of course, once you built a ring of galleries around the stage, you actually had it totally sealed in, and nobody could get in to see a play until they'd paid in advance. Mm-hmm. That was the beginning of the modern ticketing system.
Now, was the Hope Theatre a theatre that the Admiral's company also played at?
No, they didn't play in the Hope, though it was built by Edward Allen again, mm-hmm. Who built the Fortune. The Hope was originally built as a dual-purpose house. They actually took out a contract to build it just a month after the Globe burnt down in 1613 and built it right alongside the Globe with the intention of it doubling its function, being used 5 days a week for plays, mm-hmm. and one day a week for baiting the bears.
Hmm.
The bear baiting could only take place once a week, because the animals had to be allowed to recover from their wound before they were used again for baiting.
What did this place smell like?
Terrible. There's a wonderfully eloquent quote from Ben Jonson, who wrote for Bartholomew Fair, his first play for the Hope Theatre. And he said it's very appropriate, because Bartholomew Fair is supposed to be set in Smithfield, the meat market of London. And he said that this theatre is as dirty as Smithfield and is stinking every bit, with obvious good reason. And in fact, the actors were so hostile to being lodged next door to the kennels and the places where the bears and the bulls were lodged that they refused to act there after the first few months of its use. So it became just another bear garden rather than a theater.
So you,
Hope was the wrong word for it, in fact.
Hope. So you've written about how the Globe, and I assume the Rose and the Fortune Theaters, turned audiences into crowds. What do you mean by this, and what effect did it have on the experiences of a theater goer?
I think it was quite fundamental. It was, of course, in broad daylight, the audience was as visible as the actors. You didn't have any of this darkening of the audience and putting them in the dark, as we do now. And what it meant, it wasn't a novelty. It was something that we have lost, rather than anything else. All theatre was seen as something experienced by a crowd of people. And that's quite fundamental. It's something that we only rediscovered when we rebuilt the Globe in London, and people suddenly liked to come to it. I mean, the Globe has been playing to 90% capacity since it opened over 10 years ago, and it's been hugely successful simply because people like being in a crowd. You get this feeling of everybody laughing together, everybody weeping together, and you share the experience. It actually heightens your emotion, where if you're sitting silent in an armchair with no awareness of anybody else around you, mm-hmm. it's a solitary experience. Mm-hmm. Solitary experiences are far less congenial than crowd experiences.
So a collective experience is what this gives.
Exactly. It's collective. Yes, that's exactly the right word for it.
So you mentioned in these galleries, people standing. When we see a Shakespeare play today or we read it, it's hours long. And I assume that's true of the Admiral's Company also. How long were they really on stage? Did they abridge them? I mean, are they anything like the full texts that have come down to us from early printings?
This is one of my current preoccupations, actually, identifying the cuts that were made. I think there's no doubt that the plays were cut quite short, quite to much shorter events than they were. Partly, of course, because half the audience would be on their feet, standing to watch the play.
Mm-hmm.
And standing, I mean, we're used to standing for what, maybe an hour and a half, occasionally for sporting events. But we're not usually standing for 3 or 4 hours. And it seems to me pretty certain that what Shakespeare called the 2 hours traffic of the stage in Romeo and Juliet, that in other words, that the play only lasted 2 hours, seems to me to be pretty much the standard time, that the plays were cut in order to squeeze into a more manageable space. In fact, there is one case of one play of Shakespeare's in which we have two versions, one of which is half the length of the other. That's Henry V.
Mm-hmm.
The folio version that Shakespeare wrote it is twice the length of the version that the company that acted it, his own company, allowed to go on the stage.
So is there really a debate about this? It would seem obvious to me that you have these very long plays and you abridge and you test and you see what works. Is this a real point of scholarly contention?
It shouldn't be, because it seems to me self-evident that mm-hmm. the plays were cut. But, of course, everybody worships Shakespeare, and the idea of actually cutting a word of Shakespeare is a pain to any absolute devotee of Shakespeare. So they don't like to see it cut. I think they should all have been cut, and as they were cut from the very beginning, absolutely ruthlessly.
Mm-hmm.
And I would much rather have a 2-hour play than a 3-hour play.
And from the book, I get the sense, and I'm reading into it quite a bit, that if Shakespeare were alive today, you figure he would just modify the heck out of those things in order to make it fit the current environment.
I think that's very, very likely true, mm-hmm. yes. I mean, I think that he actually wrote his longer plays, like Hamlet and Richard III, knowing full well that the company was going to cut it down to size anyway.
Mm-hmm.
He just didn't care. He just gave them, as it were, a resource which they could then trim to the shape they wanted.
Mm-hmm. Now, to ask you to speculate just a little bit, do you have an opinion on which company, Shakespeare's company or the rival Admiral's company, was the more original and theatrically brilliant?
I think the Admiral's company was certainly. Part of the trouble is we can't be sure how many plays besides those of Shakespeare were staged by the Shakespeare company, by the Lord Chamberlain's men. We do have a much better idea of the range of plays that the Admiral's staged, and some of them were amazingly adventurous and very demanding plays in terms of spectacle, and the inventiveness of the disguise game that they created. That was totally an Admiral's men's invention. We have no evidence that Shakespeare invented and developed things of that kind. I think he was, in that sense, a fairly conservative figure. He picked up ideas from other companies and other plays and other playwrights, and use them in his own plays, usually rather better than they'd ever been used before, of course. But nonetheless, he was not a great innovator, a radical innovator in that sense.
Well, that brings me to my last question, and it's a big question, but we have just a little bit of time. I mean, Shakespeare, to many, is the great artist of Western civilization. I mean, you know, most famously, I think, was Harold Bloom went so far as to claim he invented the West's idea of what it means to be human. Can you speculate about why he had such a great impact, why his art is still alive? Well, the plays from the Admiral's Clubs are really kind of mere historical curiosities.
Well, Marlowe survives, it's true. I think there is a real question of quality, and that Shakespeare's plays were undoubtedly of absolutely outstanding quality, and people have been finding new things in them through the centuries all the time. There's a sense in which Shakespeare has to be reinvented by every age, because every age has different priorities and sees different things. And from that point of view, Shakespeare's plays are the richest resource, because they've been reinvented more times, more thoroughly than any other playwright ever, I think. And that's true even of the classical Greek tragedians, as well as everything else. Shakespeare was incredibly rich from that point of view. Marlowe's plays are of a more limited resource, though each one of them, of course, he wrote about six plays, each one of which was totally different from every other. So there was no, as it were, tradition of Marlowean writing able to be developed.
Andrew, I ask a very big question at the end, and we're about out of time, so I want to thank you for taking time to chat.
That's fine.
I'm Bill Hammack.
Thank you very much for listening to me.
Thank you. I'm Bill Hammack, and I've been talking with Andrew Gurr, author of Shakespeare's Opposites, The Admiral's Company, 1594 to 1625. The technical director for this segment was Henry Frayne, and the producers were Harriet Williamson and Martha Diehl. We'll have more of Focus 580 coming up in a few minutes, but first we'll break for a market update and news from National Public Radio.
WILL programs are made possible by Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Troopin, offering obstetrics, gynecology, and fertility services on Neal Street in Champaign. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance medical plan provider and is accepting new patients. More information is available at womenshealthpractice.com. WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe offers specialty coffees, breakfast featuring a choice of cold and hot breakfast items from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m., and to-go sandwiches and salads for lunch. Bevere Cafe is student-operated in Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at the Chicago Board of Trade. Both soybeans and corn have spent much of the morning rallying after starting off of the opening bell on a softer tone. Corn futures actually broke down below its 50 and 20-day moving averages today before catching some buying, and has since moved above both of those. Let's look at some particulars. In Kansas City, December wheat now at 460 and three quarters, up 1 1/4. March, 477, up 1 1/2. CME wheat, December, 444, up 2 3/4. March, 463, up 2 1/4. December corn, 343, up 9 1/2. March, 356 and a quarter, up 9 3/4. July, not trading. September, 379, up 6 3/4. November beans, 893.